Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as a tour of the battle space of the war for the free world, one of whose hottest fronts at the moment is North Korea and what it is up to and what it might mean not only for the people of the immediate area, notably South Korea, of course Japan, our bases and assets and interests in that part of the world, but perhaps even for ourselves is the subject of our first conversation with Dean Chang. He is a renowned expert on these matters in Asia and more generally the importance of what is developing in that part of the world at the Heritage Foundation, where he is a research fellow specializing in Chinese political and security affairs and, as I say, the region more generally. And Dean, welcome back. It's always good to have you with us.
Thank you for having me. Always a pleasure to be here.
We are, of course, watching this thing play out moment by moment. It seems every news cycle brings a new act of provocation, shall we say, by the North Koreans. The most recent one reminds me kind of that that Mel Brooks gag line where the guy's holding a gun to his head and saying to somebody approaching him, "Take one step closer and I'll shoot." And they've now shut down this economic zone. What's up with that? And broaden the lens to talk more about what you think North Korea is up to as a whole at the moment.
Well, frankly, I think that the decision to shut down South Korean access to the Kaesong complex is one of the scarier things to come out from a week or two of very scary events, because this sounds a lot like the kind of thing you would do if you were seriously preparing for the possibility of war. You would not want South Koreans coming into your country because many of them might be thought of as spies. Not saying they are, but if you're North Korea, you're always going to be paranoid. You're going to want that whole area, which is in a fairly sensitive physical location, to be cleared of foreign presence, because you may well be moving military equipment through the area, through the broad area, not just through the complex itself. And it's the sort of thing, again, where you are also going to be able to put pressure on your own population to say, look, we are getting ready for serious action here.
Clearing the decks, as it were.
Clearing the decks.
Yeah.
Exactly.
A scary thought, and you're absolutely right. You know, we've been most recently hearing a lot about sort of military actions. This one, as I say, has not only the kind of problems that you're talking about associated with it, which may have a military thrust as well, but it is a source of hard currency for the regime. And so to the extent that they're cutting it off, it does betoken a seriousness of purpose, shall we say. And Dean, just again, back the lens up a little bit here. This seems to be the result of the machinations of the new leader of North Korea. Is that right? Is it possible to discern who's calling the shots, him or a regent perhaps appointed to sort of help him govern or the military? Who's on first, as they say, at the moment in Pyongyang?
I think that the thing to keep in mind is that the Kim family is in charge. So there are various folks who think that Kim Jong-un, the titular leader, the son of Kim Jong-il, may not be as powerful. And you mentioned the possibility of a regent. Well, that regent is also a member of the family. So the way to think about North Korea, I think, is much more a family-owned enterprise, arguably a criminal family-owned enterprise, that moves forward to the whims and the desires of the Kim family, and especially of keeping them in power. Now, what is the role of the military in all this? I think that we too often mirror image our own civil-military divide onto foreign countries, whether it's North Korea or China or various other authoritarian regimes. The military I would suggest, is pretty firmly under the control of the Kim family, if only because they've had two generations of leaders who have had a direct hand in shaping and molding who's promoted, who is liquidated. And we've actually had a fair number of reports of both military and civilian leaders being put to death by the Kim family.
Purges in the yes. old tradition of the communists. And so your sense is, and again, Dean Chang is our guest from the Heritage Foundation, your sense, Dean, is that the military, if not actually loyal to the Kim dynasty, is at least subservient to it in a way that amounts to the same thing, that they're not an independent actor here, they're not a possible alternative, for that matter, to the dynasty should the things play out in a way that might bring about its downfall.
Not only are they not an alternative, but they are also atomized. The Kim family knows that the military is perhaps the one institution that might, if it got its act together, be able to challenge its hold. And so it is riven with informers, it is riven with divides and factions that arguably are promoted by the Kim family. Doesn't necessarily make for military efficiency, but it certainly helps to make sure that nobody tries a coup.
Now, Dean, let's talk to what has been developing prior to this most recent announcement concerning the economic zone. There have been a series of steps taken by North Korea involving sort of escalating threats involving the armistice, involving the whole idea of having hotlines to help manage crisis relations, the ongoing threats of war, putting missiles on standby, and so on. To which the United States and South Korea have responded in a way that I guess I would describe as relatively robust, given the past practice of generally appeasing and trying to placate the North when it's engaged in such steps. Is there something else going on here that we're missing, or is that a fair depiction?
I think that one of the things to keep in mind is the potential of pique on the part of our own government, that when President Obama came into office back in 2009, he was famous for saying that he wanted to offer an outstretched hand to our enemies, to Iran and to North Korea. And in the case of North Korea, they basically took that hand and slapped it away and then slapped him in the face. And that pretty much turned him off for his first term. John Kerry seems to have walked in thinking that because he's John Kerry, he'd be able to change the North Koreans. And instead, what you saw was a continuation of this sort of hand-slapping gestures. And I would therefore suggest that the Obama administration is responding robustly because they're ticked off that they're not recognized as being the light bringers by the North Korean regime.
Yeah. Our guest is Dean Chang. He is with the Heritage Foundation's Asian Studies Center, formerly worked for quite a number of years with a very renowned organization, Science Applications International Corporation, SAIC, and is deeply knowledgeable about these issues involving the often inscrutable East Asians. And let me just ask you this, Dean. The South Koreans have made it very clear, and we've actually now entered into an agreement with them, that they will respond forcibly and at a higher level of force if, in fact, there is another military attack on them, having, as I say, in the past, sat it out. Does this seem to you to suggest that we are at the cusp of a conflict, and might that conflict go nuclear if the North has its way?
Well, to unpack your question, I think that, yes, we are potentially on the cusp of a conflict. I think we have a North Korean regime that is still in the middle of its own power transition. Kim Jong-un did not have the amount of prep time that his father did. You know, Kim Jong-il had something like 20 years to get ready to take over from his father. Kim Jong-un only had a couple of years. We have a new South Korean president who is a woman and is therefore likely to be not taken quite as seriously by the North. And as a democracy, They are not in a position, having suffered an attack on a frigate and an artillery attack a couple of years ago, to sit this sort of thing out. I think any government that did that would fall. So I think we are very much on the cusp. The problem with once a conflict breaks out on the Korean Peninsula, where it will end is very unclear. And a North Korean regime that thought it was losing in particular may well feel that it has nothing to lose in a sense. Why not use its ace in the hole, which is its nuclear capability? Yeah.
Dean Chang, we are going to have to let it go at that for the moment, a moment of high drama, to say the least. I hope that you will continue to counsel with us about this as this develops, and God will steer the hand of those who are in charge at the moment, because this could go very, very seriously bad. Dean, again, thank you as always for joining us. Keep up the good work at the Heritage Foundation. We'll talk with you again very soon. Next up, Bing West on PAX, Afghanistan, Iraq, and the state of our military. Straight ahead.
We want to know what you think. Leave your comments at 1-800-332-7131.
This hurricane season, coastal residents in the Southeast and the Gulf states are urged to prepare for the uncertain conditions they may encounter in the aftermath of a major storm and make their annual contingency plans. In addition to other emergency essentials, the American Red Cross and the U.S. Department of Homeland Security recommend residents keep a diversified emergency wallet that includes cash and traveler's checks. American Express traveler's checks provide an extra measure of financial safety and security. Keeping traveler's checks and a supply of cash in small bills offers storm victims payment options to make necessary purchases. Traveler's checks never expire, providing a secure payment method whenever emergencies occur, this year and in the future. Unlike cash, they're refundable if lost or stolen. American Express traveler's checks are available at banks, credit unions, and American Express Travel Service locations across the Gulf Coast and Southeast regions. For more information, please visit www.americanexpress.com/travelerschecks.
The first step in winning a war is to know whom you're fighting. 9 years after 9/11, the U.S. security establishment has failed to tell us. The very words we need to describe the war are being outlawed. We went from the war on terror under Bush to the war on man-made disasters under Obama. Neither identifies the threat doctrine behind the aggression, Islamic Sharia law. That's why the Center for Security Policy assembled Team B, an independent group of national security professionals, including Bill Clinton's Director of Central Intelligence, James Woolsey. The result is a book that challenges the assumptions of the current administration and exposes the supremacist nature of Sharia and the jihad its adherents are obliged to engage in. This report names the names of those responsible and makes plain the mortal peril now posed to America's Constitution, our national security, and way of life. For more information, visit shariathethreat.com or order your copy of Sharia, the Threat to America at Amazon.com.
Experts say there's no shortage of crude oil.
There really is no shortage of oil at the moment.
So why do gasoline prices keep going up?
There's all this fear that's out there, and that really goes a long way to making prices go up.
And home prices seem to be headed even lower.
We really aren't seeing any markets that are showing any sustained recovery at this point.
Now more than ever, is this a timeout or a double dip?
It could halt the economy's recovery in its tracks.
1260 WRC. New choice, intelligent talk.
You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
One of the great things about being able to do a program like this is the chance to visit from time to time with a truly great American, like Bing West, our next guest. He is a former Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Affairs, way back in the administration I had the privilege of serving in as well, the Reagan administration. He is a Marine who has both fought in combat and reported brilliantly on it. After leaving the Marine Corps, through his various products in periodical journals and several outstanding books, including the most recent, Into the Fire, a first-hand account of the most extraordinary battle of the Afghan War. Bing, welcome back. It's good to have you with us, sir.
Thank you, Frank.
You have written most recently in one of those periodical journals, the National Review, under the provocative title, Seeing Khe Sanh, thinking Kabul, like the South Vietnamese Army in 1968, the Afghan Army faces its government's fall. You've written a lot about Afghanistan. You've spent a lot of time there, Bing. Tell us briefly what the thesis of your piece is here. Are we looking at a reprise of an ally abandoned and in the process of going away?
Partially, Frank, but what provoked me when I was back at my battlefields along the demilitarized zone up in Khe Sanh, where we had some huge fights, was the remembrance that as we cut our aid to South Vietnam, and we did, that President Chu, the South Vietnamese president, without informing us, took an abrupt decision that he thought was just going to consolidate his lines by pulling back some of his troops. It caused a total panic, and that's when, in 1975, Vietnam disintegrated. We face, it seems to me, in Afghanistan, a real problem, not in the immediate year, but a year or so from now when we pull out. Our Congress, the way President Karzai has behaved and the way the Afghans has behaved, will have great incentive to really cut back dramatically on the amount of money we're giving them. And the other factor is this president over there in Kabul, President Karzai, is unreliable. You don't know what he's thinking. And if he pulled a President Chu, and he's perfectly capable of it, doing something dramatic that he hasn't thought through, you could get a quick cascade that would be pretty much a disaster. I don't think we have to keep many troops there at all, but we have to keep some way of keeping the terrorists from taking over. Otherwise, we have an international defeat. And so I would strongly recommend that, but I know probably he's not going to do it, that the President Obama go to Congress and say, look, can we cut a deal to have a certain amount of money for the next 3 years for the military? And then to have our commander over there tell their military, look, we're going to take care of you. Don't worry. Don't panic. So that was what my article was about.
Yeah. And Bing, this is really obviously a very topical question because the president is in the midst, we understand, of making decisions about what kind of footprint, as they like to say, will remain behind. And certainly witness the recent trips by Secretary of Defense Chuck Hagel and Secretary of State John Kerry to Kabul and visiting with Karzai and his somewhat mercurial behavior both in the course of those meetings and subsequently and before gives rise to, as you say, a very problematic situation made perhaps more problematic by the seeming unraveling of this so-called coin strategy. Do you see it that way? Or is the strategy of trying to engage the Afghans and get them to like us really come a cropper? And if so, is it because of inherent problems with the strategy or the way it's been executed?
Well, I've been a consistent critic on the battlefields, both of Iraq and Afghanistan. I wrote a book in Vietnam called The Village, which was the combined action platoon I was with that spent 485 days in a Vietnamese village. And what we were doing in Iraq and Afghanistan bore no resemblance to what we had really done before. The fact is that General Petraeus has some brilliant sides, and a few of the other generals like McChrystal, but in other ways they do not at all, and I think they let down our troops because they bought into a theory that was preposterous and called it counterinsurgency. Their theory was nation building, that we would go to Iraq and Afghanistan, not only would they like us, but we would make them into democracies. And that was perfectly preposterous, but we all bought into that idea, and it's failed. It's just wrong.
Speaking of Iraq, Bing West, again, you've written very powerfully on that subject as well, not least from your experiences firsthand on those battlefields, including, of course, No True Glory, a frontline account of the battle for Fallujah. What are the implications of what now seems to be the failure of American policy in Iraq? Specifically, I'm thinking of the role Iran is playing there now, and perhaps, if you would, your thoughts on what's happening across the border in Syria, to boot.
President Obama, in my judgment, made a huge error in just leaving Iraq. He didn't have to. We could have applied pressure to stay there, and the map of the Middle East 10 years from now would look much better if he had made that decision. But he wanted to show that he had nothing to do with Iraq, and he pulled the plug entirely. As a result, we've left behind a hugely sectarian leader by the name of Prime Minister Maliki, and he is in bed with Assad in Syria, desperately trying to keep him in power because he doesn't want the Shia population in Syria taking power. And as a result, President Obama's gotten himself really stuck. I mean, really stuck. And it's going to show in about 2 years. It'll probably take another year to play out, frankly. The problem is, eventually, you're going to have chaos that's going to spill across the borders from Syria. They're not going to be our friends. They are going to be antagonistic toward Iraq, and with good reason, because Iraq keeps backing Assad and allowing the Iranians to fly over its territory to help the Assad government that's going to fall. And Iraq is falling more and more under the domain of Iran. So, you know, it's just a bad-looking situation, no matter how you look at it. And President Obama has gradually painted himself into a corner.
Right. Short-term expediency-driven political considerations placed over public safety, you might say. Certainly exactly. sound policy. Bing West is our guest. He is a former Assistant Secretary of Defense under President Ronald Reagan, a combat marine and a chronicler par excellence of what is happening in our world, and particularly with and to our military. And Bing, let me ask you in closing about your sense as a guy with a lot of time spent now with the troops, sons who've served in the military, as I recall, recently as well. What is your appreciation of the condition of our armed forces today? And what is it likely to be as the kinds of cuts that are now being meted out, the budget cuts and so on, translate into impact on training and op tempos and deployments and the modernization of our forces?
It's the latter, the modernization, that bothers me the most, Frank. We're going to cut back pretty dramatically on the Army and the Marine Corps. And certainly no one, given the mood of the country, is going to be using them again soon in a major way. But the modernization of all our forces so that we can keep China in a small sphere of influence that is legitimate for China, but not allow it to start throwing its weight around in the Pacific, that's a problem for about 20 years from now. And if you look at our aircraft and our ships, there's just not going to be enough of them. And so the biggest problem that I see of what we're doing with this sequestration, and but beyond that, the president just honestly doesn't care about the long-term military, is that the president after this president is not going to have adequate forces.
And they may not be ones that we use at our discretion. They may have to be used in response to something that other people do in the face of what they perceive to be our weakness. Bing West, I couldn't agree with you more on that. I hope your timelines are right. I'm afraid that we'll find the problems in Iraq and the neighboring countries manifesting themselves far more rapidly, and maybe that problem with China doing so as well. But no one will chronicle it better than you, I know, and we'll look forward to visiting with you, I hope, often about it. And thank you for taking this time with us today. Next up, Rowan Scarborough will give us his sense from the Washington Times on some of these same issues, particularly the military cuts and how they're translating into real impact. Straight ahead.
To SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Hi, NBA forward Kevin Durant from the Oklahoma City Thunder. Here with Bugs Bunny and Daffy Duck to remind you to get moving every day.
Because when you get moving an hour a day,
you'll have more energy to do the things you like to do.
And that's a slam dunk.
Whether you like to shoot hoops like me, skateboard, ride a bike,
or dance on your roof, just move it your way.
For an hour a day. Because moving every day puts you on the offense towards a stronger you.
And and that makes you part of a winning team.
I couldn't have said it better myself, Bugs.
So be a player.
Be a player.
Get up, play, and move it your way. Check out how to be a player at letsmove.gov.
Head online to get tips on great ways to get moving every day.
You said it at www.letsmove.gov. Let's hear that one more time, Doc. That's www.letsmove.gov. A message from the Ad Council and HHS.
This is Frank Gaffney with the Secure Freedom Minute. Hillary Clinton launched her 2016 campaign for the White House yesterday with a speech in Washington. No, she didn't actually declare her candidacy, but the fact that she coyly refuses to do so simply feeds what a once and future politician craves most, namely public clamor for a presidential run. The topic of her first speech since leaving the State Department signals trouble ahead, though. It addressed women's rights around the world. Yet, as Secretary of State, she helped enable the greatest setback for women in decades with the rise of Islamists across the Middle East and North Africa. Hillary's role in that disaster for women and the rest of us, and that of her Muslim Brotherhood-associated aide, Huma Abedin, will be fair game in her bid for the White House. This is Frank Gaffney with the Secure Freedom Minute. Learn more at securefreedom.org.
In 1966 in Anchorage, Alaska, a talented child was born. He would go on to be one out of only 11 Alaskans to make it to the major leagues. The odds of him striking out more than 3,000 hitters? 1 in 33 million. The odds of this pitcher being selected to the Major League Baseball All-Star Game 6 times? 1 in 48 million. The odds of this fast-balling philanthropist winning the World Series 3 times? 1 in 3 million. The odds of this man having a child diagnosed with autism? 1 in 110. Hi, I'm Kurt Schilling. Learn the signs of autism at autismspeaks.org. Autism is getting closer to home. From 1 in 5,000 only 20 years ago, today 1 in 110 children are diagnosed. Early diagnosis can make a lifetime of difference. Autism Speaks. It's time to listen. Brought to you by Autism Speaks and the Ad Council. Major League Baseball trademarks used with permission.
The Devil We Don't Know by Noni Darwish uncovers the dark side of revolution in the Middle East and the reason why Muslim countries are unable to dig themselves out of a cycle of revolution, political unrest, and tyranny. The constitutions of many Muslim countries state that Sharia law supersedes all other law, and that is why it has failed in providing a legal and political system where healthy democracy can flourish. In this dynamic, only tyrannical governments can survive. In The Devil We Don't Know, human rights activist and Center for Security Policy fellow Noni Darwish answers the tough questions. Why the Arab Spring won't usher in freedom and democracy or a feminist movement. And how Israel will be threatened by the new wave of Islamism after the so-called Arab Spring. The Devil We Don't Know by Noni Darwish. It's available at Amazon.com.
Hi, this is Frank Effney. You're listening to Intelligent Talk on WRC 1260 in Washington, D.C.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
One of the people we turn to regularly for commentary and analysis of what is happening in the military and to it, among other issues, is our friend Rowan Scarborough. He is an ace reporter, a veteran reporter at that, on Pentagon Matters at the Washington Times. He is the author of Rumsfeld's War, The Untold Story of America's Anti-Terrorist Commander, and a very, very knowledgeable and skilled journalist. It's always a pleasure to have you with us.
Glad to be with you, Frank.
Let's start with something that you've been writing about, and I really want to get your sort of sense of the ground truth on it. We talked a little bit in the previous segment, Rowan, with Bing West, about the effects that we're going to see over time, for sure, from these cutbacks that are taking place in our military expenditures and capabilities. And, you know, I have very high regard for the recently departed commander of the U.S. Central Command, General Jim Mattis. And I was told that he made a comment recently to the effect that we're going to do less as a result of these cuts, but we're going to do nothing less well. And I wonder whether that is perhaps a case of whistling past the graveyard on some of these cuts and the impacts that they're likely to have, Rowan. You've written that the press isn't really crediting these warnings, but what's your independent assessment of how serious the problem is?
Well, I would disagree with General Mattis. I mean, when he requests two carriers to be in the Persian Gulf region, and because of budget cuts, there's only one, to me, that's doing things less well. It means we can't have a carrier off the coast of Pakistan to support Afghanistan and one in the Persian Gulf to keep an eye on Iran. That's the situation we're in right now. So that's, by definition, to me, that's less well. And I think what has happened, the Pentagon has put on this enormous PR campaign. First of all, Frank, they didn't even plan for sequestration. It was like they had their head in the sand. It didn't exist.
Well, they weren't allowed to, were they, Rowan? Wasn't that the point? They were ordered not to plan for it, because if they did, and for that matter, if they had the WARN notices issued to the defense industry or by the defense industry, that might have had a negative effect on the election.
That's part of it, but as far as I can tell, there was no pushback from the chiefs to say, hey, if we're going to do this as best we can in 2013, we need to start making preparations right now with the 2012 budget, which they did not do. And General Odinero, the chief of staff of the Army, was asked point blank, why didn't you attempt to get the ball rolling in the Pentagon and convince the White House? And Odinero said, because the chiefs never thought this was going to happen. That, to me, is a bit of having your head in the sand. Instead, they were never close to an agreement in 2012, and that would have been a good time to begin at least preliminary planning. But you're right, the White House was in an election. They didn't want any talk out there of work being stopped or people being furloughed. And so that was part of the equation, no doubt about it.
But I think what you've suggested, and let me put a fine point on it, is a kind of dereliction of duty on the part of the chiefs that they didn't push back. And of course, we have the tradition and revere the tradition of, you know, civilian control of the military. But at some point, when it comes to really being able to do the job they're expected to do and not planning for the circumstances that at least, you know, could eventuate. I mean, we've got all kinds of contingency plans in the Pentagon for things that may never happen, but that in the event that they do happen, you want to have some sort of plan of attack to engage. Where do you think this failure comes from? Is it a politicization of the military? Is it the choice of the individuals who are now in leadership positions because they will, in fact, fail to do what should be done in the face of this kind of politicized pressure?
I believe it. Part of it, Frank, starts at the top with the chairman, Martin Dempsey, General Dempsey. I believe he is very much in sync with the White House. I think he was chosen because they believe they have somebody that will agree with them on major issues. I mean, he's pushed women in combat very, very hard, like sending a message out to commanders that, you know, you better get women into combat. I mean, this is what the White House wants. And I think that's part of the culture that is taking over the chiefs to submit to the White House. And I think if the right tack had been taken, there would have been a vigorous argument among the chiefs with the White House about why are we sitting here every day saying we're ignoring the Budget Control Act, which is, to me, is you say dereliction of duty. It just doesn't make any sense. And then, bingo, in January, all of a sudden tell Congress that we're crashing. You know, we can't deploy this, we can't train this, we can't do air shows, we have to bring ships back to port. I mean, that was so much to throw on Congress in 1 month. You know, like 400 different options we're now putting into play when they had more than a year to plan for that. And I think the press now, the liberal press and even some of the conservative press, is starting to call the Pentagon on some of these, it's not crying wolf, but the alarm bells that they're sounding, and they're starting to look into all the money that could have been saved if the Pentagon had spent its money more wisely during the cash flush years. And you even see the Lexington Institute, which is a pro-business, pro-defense think tank, writing columns about how the Pentagon needs a Manhattan Project now for how it buys weapons. It needs to just entirely change the culture. So that's kind of the pushback that the Pentagon is getting right now.
Well, that's where I wanted to go to next with you is do the folks in the press, and look, I don't think there's much disagreement that we ought to overhaul our acquisition process. It is hopelessly broken. Rowan Scarborough, you've been around this town long enough, and you've covered the Pentagon certainly long enough to know that it is a centerpiece of many of the problems that they have, both with cost overruns and with the prodigious amount of time it takes to get new weapons into the mix. I was at a conference yesterday where one senior military official was saying, you know, in an environment where Apple brings a new iPhone online every 10 months or so, and it takes us 10 years to bring a new weapon system to bear, something is seriously wrong. But to the extent that the press is not covering this story, or they're covering the story in a way that suggests great skepticism about the warnings that are coming from the military, are we getting an accurate picture of just how serious this problem is likely to be? And if you could tie into it the defense industrial base as well, it's really an element of this that I think is also in need of attention.
No, I mean, the press right now is focused on the first year sequestration and the wasteful spending that the Pentagon has done in recent years. That's really the focus, and they have not started to focus yet on the out years. Sequestration is the first year, but then the budget continues to decline by about $50 billion for the next 9 years, and that means the military is not just going to have to stop deployments or curtail the deployments. Then that comes into the muscle of the military, where you're going to have to look at manpower, you're going to have to look at new weapons, and all of those are going to have to come down if you're going to meet these targets, and then we will have the hollow military. I think it's impossible to take another $1 trillion out of this military over the next 10 years and not end up with units that just cannot function correctly. And so that's the story that isn't being told right now.
Well, it is, and it's one of the reasons why we turned to you to tell that story. Very quickly, Rowan, one other story and a related one that you've just recently written about is that it costs something like $162,000 per flight hour to fly the president around in Air Force One. Can we afford that?
That's just about the most expensive plane to fly in the Air Force arsenal, Air Force One. It's an old plane. It eats up fuel because those engines, three engines, have to power all sorts of operations.
Four engines, I believe.
Yes. And so President Obama is using that plane quite actively to campaign still in the second term while, you know, they're cutting off access to the White House and cutting down flying hours of actual warplanes that need to be in the air. So the point of that story is, hey, you know, if the president maybe, you know, could put a better example up and maybe curtail some of his campaigning, they could save money right there.
Big time.
You know, go on with these tours.
Big time, and maybe keep the kids home for a staycation as well, which would also save some serious money. Rowan Scarborough, as always, thank you very much for your insights. Great reporting at the Washington Times. Keep it up and keep coming back to us. We'll look forward to visiting with you again very soon. Next up, Diana West joins us to talk about how Uncle Sam is helping to build out the Saudi Crescent. Straight ahead.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Do you see that doggy in the shelter?
Hi, I'm Buddy, the adorable puppy you adopted from the Humane Society.
Meow. I'm Whiskers, a fluffy kitty, just waiting for someone to love me.
When you adopt a pet, we hope your new furry friend will become a cherished member of your family. And as Buddy and Whiskers will tell you, the key to success is following the rules to love by.
Woof, that's right. Please give me food, water, and exercise every day. To stay healthy, I need the same kind of things you need.
Talk to me. I like hearing your voice.
You're my best friend. Please don't stay mad at me or lock me up as punishment. Remember, I'm probably going to live 10 to 15 years, so take care of me when I get old.
One day you'll need someone to take care of you, too.
A message from the Montgomery County Humane Society. Visit www.mchumane.org for the complete rules to love by.
Be your best friend for life.
Hi, this is Frank Gaffney. My day job is running the Center for Security Policy, which each weeknight brings you this program. But Secure Freedom Radio is just one of the important contributions the Center makes to the common defense. We call our team the Special Forces in the War of Ideas. Like the real Special Forces, we strive to be agile, creative, and highly effective in identifying threats to our country and how they might best be countered. We can't do all this without you, though. Also, like the real Special Forces, ours need ammunition. And in the War of Ideas, ammo is money. The Center is a nonprofit, tax-exempt organization. Contributions to its work are tax-deductible and an important investment in your security and freedom. Find out more about the Center for Security Policy and how you can help keep its Special Forces team in the fight by visiting securefreedom.org. Many thanks.
The first step in winning a war is to know whom you're fighting. 9 years after 9/11, the U.S. security establishment has failed to tell us. The very words we need to describe the war are being outlawed. We went from the war on terror under Bush to the war on man-made disasters under Obama. Neither identifies the threat doctrine behind the aggression, Islamic Sharia law. That's why the Center for Security Policy assembled Team B, an independent group of national security professionals, including Bill Clinton's Director of Central Intelligence, James Woolsey. The result is a book that challenges the assumptions of the current administration and exposes the supremacist nature of Sharia and the jihad its adherents are obliged to engage in. This report names the names of those responsible and makes plain the mortal peril now posed to America's Constitution, our national security, and way of life. For more information, visit shariathethreat.com or order your copy of Sharia, the Threat to America at amazon.com.
Hi, I'm Casey Kane. You would think that as NASCAR's 2004 Rookie of the Year, I get my biggest thrill driving fast. But it's off the racetrack that I get one of life's greatest rewards, helping others through volunteer service. Working with kids is one way that I try to make a difference. The first time I visited chronically ill children in the hospital, I found out just how rewarding volunteering could be. By giving a little of my time, it brightened their day. I was so inspired that I started my own foundation to help sick children and kids without an opportunity to have a better chance at life. Through volunteer service, you learn things about the people you're helping, and you find out a few things about yourself. Volunteering is a rush, just like taking the checkered flag. Go to volunteer.gov to find out what drives you.
This is President George W. Bush. USA Freedom Corps has a volunteer opportunity that's just right for you. Visit volunteer.gov. When you help your neighbor, you help your nation.
So what's the deal? You gonna get a job now or what?
Did you have to shoot anyone?
Why are you so distant? Are you not happy to see me?
No one knows what it's like to come back from Iraq or Afghanistan unless they were there. Join other veterans at communityofveterans.org, brought to you by Iraq and Afghanistan Veterans of America and the Ad Council.
To securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back. We're joined by Diana West, who we have the very great privilege of seeing, or at least speaking to, each week at this time. Diana, welcome back. It's good to have you with us. How are you?
Thank you, Frank. Glad to be here.
Let's talk a little bit about an essay that you have written, and you can find her many syndicated pieces and other super blocking at dianawest.net about the Saudi Crescent. First of all, let's talk a little bit about what that is, or what it might yet be, and what role the United States government seems to be playing in expanding it.
I have been perplexed, frankly, by watching the current policies unfold, as we've been watching them in the so-called Arab Spring, which I don't even think we have to use that phrase anymore. It seems to have withered away. But in terms of watching the strategy that is unfolding in the Middle East, in Syria, having gone from Libya, Egypt, Tunisia, Syria, and trying to put it into some sort of historical context. And I was taken with a recent piece that was pointing out, this was by Tony Cartolucci, that was pointing out some reporting that Seymour Hersh had done back in 2007 in The New Yorker, where he had focused on changes in the Bush administration policy in the Middle East that seemed to kind of bring into relief something I'd been thinking about as well, which namely is the notion that all of this is being done in some way to freeze out Iran. And in other words, that Syria and Iran being allies are the current focus of these very messy and dangerous revolutions we see going on, put forward by Muslim Brotherhood and Al-Qaeda and other jihad forces. So how
of the Sunni persuasion, this is the important common denominator, I guess, is that they line up against the Shias of Iran.
Well, yes, although we have Sunnis also in Syria, so it doesn't quite work, but Syria and Iran definitely work together.
But the Sunnis in Syria are aligning with the Muslim Brotherhood, more or less, it seems, and against Assad. Am I missing something here?
Well, I think there's a mixture. I think we do see a mixture. But the point is that the Bush administration essentially laid this strategy out. And indeed, Condoleezza Rice spoke of it at the time in terms of advancing, this is back in 2006-07, advancing what she was talking about as a Sunni crescent. And indeed, we
see... She literally used that term?
Yes.
Wow, that is...
Yes, the Sunni crescent. Mm. And this was supposed to include the Shiite obvious majority in Iraq that would somehow be compelled to blend in with this Sunni crescent against Iran. And none of it's working out. And what I really think is going on is this was a tremendous deception that was sold to the Bush administration and others, and including continuing on in the Obama administration, to convince America to get behind Al-Qaeda and the Muslim Brotherhood as a means of isolating what has been painted as our largest and dominant enemy, Iran, completely ignoring the fact that Sunni Islam is equally as dangerous, equally as threatening to the Western way of life. And so, in other words, we have, I think, been completely sold a line of goods in terms of presenting, pushing these various Sunni elements forward.
Yeah. And let's just drill down on who some of these elements are, Diana West, because as you know so well, we are being told, most especially by the Obama administration, that at least some are people we can do business with, notably the Muslim Brotherhood. What do we know about the Muslim Brotherhood that suggests that far from being people we can do business with, these are people who are determined to destroy us, every bit as much as Al-Qaeda and for that matter, the Iranians of the Shia stripe?
Well, exactly. What we know about them, that the only thing we need to know about them is that they are driven to spread Sharia throughout the world and establish a caliphate, which, of course, happens to coincide with the aims of all the other Islamic elements we're talking about. They all are on the same page when it comes to this. And they just pretend that they have different names and different, you know, resumes, basically.
Or different Sharia, or sometimes
different Sharia, sometimes, although basically they have the same attitudes toward non-Muslims, which is really all we need to focus on. The operative part that affects us. But what we're seeing, I mean, and also Muslim Brotherhood and Al-Qaeda have been intimately linked right from the beginning. You had Osama bin Laden joining the Muslim Brotherhood as a college student.
Indeed.
I mean,
and his son-in-law having resided there until happily recently picked up. Now in New York City awaiting trial.
Diana, there's one point, though, that I think is very illustrative of the continuity of this terrible, disastrous policy, and that is that 2 days after 9/11, within 48 hours, Prince Bandar, who was then the ambassador from Saudi Arabia to America, was sitting on the portico of the White House smoking cigars with President Bush and discussing, well, we don't exactly know, but we suspect it had something to do with airlifting over 150 Saudis out of the country, including many who should have been interviewed by the FBI. Flash forward.
Or interrogated, as the case may be, right?
Correct. Or arrested. Flash forward to 2013, and we're getting reports from various sources, not necessarily on the front pages of our mainstream media yet, but enough of them to wonder whether there is truth to this, that it is Prince Bandar who is actually enabling and pushing and funding the Al-Nusra Front, which is the most vicious jihadist front in Syria at this moment that is taking over the rebel side.
That the State Department has actually designated as a terrorist organization, to the great consternation and unhappiness of its allies, some of whom we are apparently now trying to bring to power in Syria. Diana, which brings me to the State Department, which of course has made that designation. It was done under Hillary Clinton's watch. Hillary Clinton, of course, made a speech yesterday before, I think it was the Women in the World Summit, about the plight of women. And I just want, having heard, as you have done so nicely, the sort of backdrop to this policy during the Bush years, continuing and accelerating under the Obama administration, of trying to bring to power, trying to, essentially expand the reach of the very people who are arguably the most serious threat to women in the world today, namely Islamists of these various stripes throughout the Middle East and North Africa. Were you of the view that what Hillary was doing was really launching, without acknowledging it, of course, her presidential campaign for 2016? And does she, in fact, have a vulnerability on this score, what she has done to help empower enemies of women in the Middle East through her time in the State Department?
Now, let me answer your second question first. With another question, how stupid are we? How stupid are we, the American people, to buy this utter line of flimflam from Hillary Clinton, exactly as you describe it, in terms of advancing the Islamic reach of Sharia, which one of its primary objects of suppression is women? How can we buy that she can do this on the one hand, that letting alone her own role in enabling her husband, the serial sexual abuser,
predator,
to remain predator in office, and to stand up for him as well. So she has a terrible history, in other words, both on the personal level and on a macro, gigantic, global level, of doing things to cover up for the worst kinds of depredations against women, now announcing her probable presidential run, certainly a testing of the waters.
Telegraphing it, presumably to try to encourage titillating demands that she run, which is the most cynical of these efforts. But very quickly, Diana, we have less than a minute. Tell us about Huma Abedin and her role in all of this.
Well, we don't know, but we do know that the day that Hillary Clinton left the State Department, so did Huma Abedin. And it was reported in the New York Post that she is likely to report for work at some point at the Clinton Global Initiative, Bill Clinton's multi-bazillion dollar
Saudi funded.
Qatari, you name it, funded
plot thickens. Yes, indeed. Well, we have to let it go at this. Huma Abedin is closely tied to the Muslim Brotherhood. She worked for Hillary Clinton for 12 or so years in her various other capacities. We will be following on the campaign trail, you can bet, the role of Huma Abedin and her specific responsibility for promoting this plight of women that the Muslim Brotherhood and its friends are perpetrating. Diana West, we have to let you go. Thank you for joining us. Do it again next week. I hope the rest of you will do so again tomorrow, same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
From the nation's capital, you've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.